This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a memoir. Written and read by Sherman Alexie. Dedication. For Arnold, Kim, Arlene, and James. Chapter 1, 40 Knives. In 1972 or 1973, or maybe in 1974, my mother and father hosted a dangerous New Year's Eve party at our home in Wahpenet, Washington, on the Spokane Indian Reservation. We lived in a two-story house. The first floor was a doorless daylight basement, while the elevated second floor had front and back doors accessible by 14-step staircases. The house was constructed by our tribe using grant money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, more tersely known as HUD. Our family HUD house was new but only half finished when we moved in, and remains unfinished and illogically designed over 40 years later. It was worth $25,000 when it was built, and I think it's probably worth about the same now. I don't speak my tribal language, but I'm positive there are no Spokane Indian words for real estate appreciation. The top floor of our HUD house contains a tiny bathroom with an unusually narrow door and a small windowless kitchen, both included as afterthoughts and deadline sketches hurriedly drawn by a tribal secretary who had no architectural education. I didn't grow up in a dream house. I lived in a wooden improvisation. On the top floor with the kitchen and bathroom, there was also a minuscule bedroom that was shared by my little sisters, identical twins, during childhood. My sisters, Kim and Arlene, never married, and nearly 50 years old now, have never lived more than 1 mile apart, so perhaps they cannot escape their twinly proximity. Also on the top floor of our HUD house is the master bedroom, where my late father slept alone, and a disproportionately large living room, where my late mother slept on a couch. My late father, Sherman Alexie Sr., was a Coeur d'Alene Indian. He was physically graceful and strong, adept at ballroom waltzes, powwow dancing, and basketball, and always smelled of the smoke of one good cigar intermingled with dozens of cheap stogies. As a teenager, he began to resemble the actor Charles Bronson, and that resemblance only increased with age. Introverted, depressed, he spent most of his time solving crossword puzzles while watching TV. My late mother, Lillian Alexie, crafted legendary quilts and was one of the last fluent speakers of our tribal language. She was small, just under 5 feet tall when she died. And she was so beautiful and verbose and brilliant, she could have played a fictional version of herself in a screwball Hollywood comedy if Hollywood had ever bothered to cast real Indians as fictional Indians. I don't know if my parents romantically loved each other. I am positive they platonically loved each other very much. My mother and father slept separately from the time we moved into that HUD house in the early 1970s until his death from alcoholic kidney failure in 2003. And then my mother continued to sleep alone on a living room couch, on a series of living room couches, until her death in 2015. My parents were not a physically affectionate couple. I never saw, heard, or sensed any evidence other than the existence of us children, that my mother and father had sex at any point during their marriage. If forced to guess at the number of times my parents had been naked and damp together, I would probably say, well, they conceived 4 children together. So let's say they had sex 3 times for keeps, the twins only count for 1, and 4 times for kicks. My big brother Arnold and I each had our own mostly finished basement bedrooms. but he spent much of his time living and traveling with a family of cousins like they were surrogates for his parents and siblings. I love my brother, but he sometimes felt like a stranger in those early years, and I imagine he might say the same about me in our later years. Never married, but in a decade-long relationship with a white woman, he is loud and hilarious and universally beloved in our tribe. The furnace and laundry rooms, also in the basement, are cement-floored with bare wood stud walls. Dug 5 feet into the ground, our basement flooded with every serious rainstorm and has smelled of mold and subsequent disinfectant fluids from the beginning of time. My little brother James, who is also our second cousin, was adopted by my parents when he was a toddler. 15 years younger than me, he would eventually take over my bedroom after I went away to college. He was so starved when we got him that he would devour any food or drink in his vicinity, including other people's meals. While we were distracted, he once drank my father's 64-ounce big gulp of Diet Pepsi in one long pull. He was only 3 years old. We thought it was funny. We didn't ponder why a kid would come to us so very thirsty. James was only 5 years old when I moved away from the reservation, so I think I have been more like his absent uncle than his big brother. Smart and handsome and thin and also married to a white woman, James has a master's degree in business. My little brother is my favorite capitalist. But that inexpertly constructed HUD house was still a spectacular and vital mansion compared to the 19th century one-bedroom house where I spent most of the first 7 years of my life. That ancient reservation house didn't have indoor plumbing or electricity when my parents, siblings, and I first moved in, along with an ever-changing group of friends, cousins, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. I most vividly remember my half-sister Mary. She was 13 years older than me, and seemed more like a maternal figure than sibling. Even more beautiful than our gorgeous mother, Mary was a charming and random presence in my life. She was profane and silly, and dressed like a hippie white girl mimicking a radical Indian. In later years, I would learn that Mary's randomness and charm, and her eventual death in a house fire, were fueled by her drug and alcohol addictions. I didn't yet know that romantic heroes, famous and not, are usually aimless nomads in disguise. Mary's father lived in Montana, on the Flathead Indian Reservation, so she sometimes lived with him, and sometimes lived with us, and sometimes shacked up with Indian men who reeked of marijuana and beer, or with white men who looked like roadies for Led Zeppelin. A mother at 15, Mary gave her baby, my niece, to our Aunt Inez to raise. My niece is only a few years younger than me, and I still don't understand why my mother didn't take her into our home. My parents raised one of our cousins as a son, and my sisters would eventually raise another cousin as a daughter. So why didn't our niece become our sister? I never asked my parents those questions. But, in writing the first draft of this very paragraph, I realized for the first time that my father, so passive in nearly all ways, might have said no to raising a granddaughter who was not his biological relative. I feel terrible for considering this possibility. Could my father have done such a thing? Could he have been such an alpha lion? I don't know. I don't think so. I hope not. So why didn't my mother raise her granddaughter? I doubt that I'll ever be able to answer that question. There are family mysteries I cannot solve. There are family mysteries I am unwilling to solve. Before her death, my mother told me that she liked to sleep alone on a couch in her later years because she'd only slept in crowded beds and bedrooms for most of her younger life. I never would have thought of a lumpy couch as a luxury, but my mother certainly did. Sometimes, when I was little and afraid and screaming from yet another nightmare, I would fitfully sleep on a smaller couch in the HUD house living room near my mother's larger couch. Born hydrocephalic, with abnormal amounts of cerebral spinal fluid crushing my brain, I had surgery at 5 months to insert the shunt and then had it removed when I was 2. I suffered seizures until I was 7 years old, so I was a kindergartner on phenobarbital. I've alternated between insomnia and hypersomnia my whole life. I begin dreaming immediately upon falling asleep, a condition called shortened REM latency that can be a precursor, indicator, cause, and result of depression. I have always been haunted by nightmares, by ghosts, real or imagined. I have always heard voices, familiar and strange. I was officially diagnosed as bipolar in 2010, but I think my first symptoms appeared when I was a child. For Christmas in 1976, when I was 10, I received a plastic Guns of Navarone battle playset with Allied and Nazi soldiers, cannons, tanks, and planes. I added my own Indian and U.S. cavalry toy soldiers and manically played war for 22 hours straight. My parents didn't stop me. They didn't tell me to go to bed. My mania was accepted. In the context of my family, I wasn't being odd. Rather, I was behaving like my mother, who would often work on her quilts for even longer, sleepless stretches. I often stayed awake all night reading books and writing stories and playing the board games I invented. If I were especially agitated and lucky, I would have a new graph paper notebook, and I would carefully color in thousands of squares, one by one, until I was calm enough to sleep. I think I inherited my bipolar disorder from my mother. I believe she was haunted by ghosts, too. I also believe she has become a ghost, either as a supernatural being or as a hallucination caused by my various mental illnesses and medications, or as the most current and vivid product of my imagination. Thing is, I don't believe in ghosts, but I see them all the time. "You slept on that living room couch for years," my mother's ghost said to me while I was writing this memoir. "You never used your basement bedroom until you were 11 or 12. I had you sleep close to me because you had those seizures, and I had to keep you safe, and I had to give you medicine in the middle of the night, and because you were always scared." "That's not how I remember sleeping," I said. "I remember moving into the basement bedroom on my first night." "You used to wet your bed," my mother's ghost said. "You wet the couch until you were 13, I think." "I stopped wetting the bed long before that," I said. "Do you remember that I would lay down a shower curtain on the couch and then lay down your sheets and blanket?" my mother's ghost asked. "That was only in the old house," I said. "Never in the HUD house." "It was in both places," she said. "You had bladder issues even when you were awake. Do you remember when you drove to Spokane with your cousins for a birthday party? But you were too nervous to go into a house filled with city Indians you didn't know, so you stayed outside in the car and peed your pants because you were too scared to go to the bathroom in a stranger's house?" I lied and said, "I don't remember that happening." "I think you forget things on purpose," my mother's ghost said. "I do remember when the white men in gray overalls installed the first indoor toilet on our ancient 19th century house. But I can't recall when the place was wired for electricity and the first light bulb was switched on. When performing for crowds, I like to say, when I was a kid, I shared an outhouse with 16 Indians, but I only remember 14 of them. That primitive house was infinitely better than the series of filthy highway motels and filthier downtown hotels in and around Spokane, where we'd sometimes stay for days or weeks, whenever my parents had extra money, or a temporary job, or needed a sad-ass sabbatical from reservation life. My parents sold blood for money to buy food. Poverty was our spirit animal. Once, when he was only 5 or 6, my big brother told my aunt that he was going to hawk all of our furniture to the pawn shop, just like Mom and Dad always do, so he could buy Kentucky Fried Chicken. My aunt, the white one, told me that story. My big brother doesn't remember it. He said, "That chicken thing sounds more like something you'd write in a book than something I would say for real." I vividly remember moving from that old house into our HUD house only 50 yards away. The front and back stairs were not yet built, so we had to climb a ladder to get into the place. Ludicrous, I know, but it felt magical. I remember a photograph of us four children posing on the ladder. We looked more like mesa-dwelling Hopi Indians than salmon-fishing Spokane Indians. My little sister doesn't remember that photograph. She doubts it exists. "You're always making up stuff from the past," she said. "And the stuff you imagine is always better than the stuff that actually happened." "That's just a fancy way of calling me a liar," I said. "If the moccasin fits, then wear it," she said. I don't recall the moment when I officially became a storyteller, a talented liar. But here, I must quote Simon Ortiz, the Acoma Pueblo writer, who said, "Listen, if it's fiction, then it better be true." Simon, a beautiful storyteller, doesn't remember ever saying such a thing. "That sounds like something I might say," he said to me. "But I don't know if I have ever said that particular thing." I don't remember when I first learned of that quote. Did I read it in one of Simon's poems or stories? If so, then why doesn't Simon remember that he wrote it? Can a writer forget something that he's written in one of his own books? Yes, of course. I wrote my first novel over 2 decades ago, and fans often stump me by asking questions about passages that I don't remember writing. So perhaps I read that quote somewhere else and have mistakenly attributed it to Simon. Or did I hear somebody else quote Simon? My college writing teacher, Alex Kuo, is a big fan of literary-inspired practical jokes and postmodern riddles. So maybe he's the one who quoted or misquoted Simon. "Do you know the Simon Ortiz quote about fiction and truth?" I asked Alex. "Did you tell me he said it?" "No," he said. "I don't remember that quote. But that doesn't mean I didn't tell you I knew it sometime in the past. I could have invented it, or maybe you invented the quote and are giving me partial credit for citing the quote while fully crediting Simon for originally inventing the quote." "So maybe I'm the one who thought it first," I said, "and I want to honor you and Simon." "Well," Alex said, "crediting your thoughts to your mentor sounds more like you're honoring yourself." "That's funny," I said, and sad. Is my ego the source of all my deception and self-deception? "Perhaps," Alex said. "Since you've just invented this entire conversation about storytelling and truth that you and I never had and put it in the first chapter of your memoir, then I'm just going to call you the unreliable narrator of your own life." So, okay, maybe I am unreliable to some degree. But despite what my teachers, parents, friends, siblings, and I say about my storytelling, about my labyrinthine fantasy life, I also know that I have an excellent memory. To quote a song lyric I vaguely remember from a song and band I can't fully recall, I remember everything. I remember that my mother and father hosted a New Year's Eve party in our HUD house on the Spokane Indian Reservation in 1973 or 1972 or 1974. I was only 7 years old, but I knew with a fundamentalist's fervor that the party was potentially lethal. Not because of my mother and father's actions, but because of their inattentions. There were alcoholics who'd get what they laughingly called bottle blind, as in, "I was so bottle blind that I didn't even realize I'd driven off the road until I woke up with a pine tree branch sticking through the car windshield about 4 inches from my nose." That's what my father said, or approximately what he said, after his 11th or 19th or 27th drunken car wreck. So yes, my bottle-blind parents invited everybody on the reservation to that dangerous New Year's Eve party, including two Indian men who were widely believed, who were known to have committed murders. One of those murderers, a half-white little guy with a wicked temper and a silly-ass gunfighter's mustache, had supposedly buried his victim's body in Manitou Park in Spokane. An anonymous person had called into a secret witness phone line and claimed that my father, while not guilty of the murder, knew where the body was buried. My father had twice been in prison for burglary and forgery, so he was certainly known to the police. They must have taken that anonymous call seriously because they asked my father to come in and answer a few questions. And I still find it strange and hilarious that my father took me, only 9 or 10 years old, along on that little cold case adventure. As my father drove us from the reservation to the police station in Spokane, he told me that he'd only heard the same rumors about the murder as everybody else. "They could talk to every Indian around here," my father said, "and we'd all tell the same story." My father was a shy and gentle man, even when drunk, so I don't believe that he was capable of physically hurting anybody. But he was also an alcoholic who was exceedingly loyal to other indigenous folks and deeply suspicious of any authority figure. I knew that my father would protect any Indian against any investigation by white men. My father wouldn't throw a punch or pull a trigger or name names. Silence was his sharp bow and quiver of arrows. I didn't witness that interview, or maybe I should call it a casual interrogation, and my father never shared any of the details. I just waited for hours in our family car outside the police station as he told the story, or did not tell the story, about his alleged role, or non-role, in that murder. He must have been innocent of any wrongdoing, because he was free to drive us back to the reservation that day, and was never compelled to speak of the incident again. But I still wonder if there is a body buried in Manitou Park. I still wonder if my father knew where to find that body. I know exactly where my dead father is buried. Maybe I'll interrogate his tombstone the next time I visit that reservation cemetery. "How many murderers did you know?" I will ask the tombstone again and again. And the tombstone will never answer, because the dead have only the voices we give to them. The other murderer at that New Year's Eve party was a Vietnam War veteran. Not long after he'd been honorably discharged and returned to the reservation, he and some Indian friends attacked a white man. According to the stories, the war vet kicked the white man's eye clean out of his head and then dumped him to die in a roadside ditch. Today, some folks say the man survived the beating and that cold night spent unconscious in the dirt and moved to another state. Some say the beating wasn't that bad in the first place. It was just an ordinary fight, as ordinary as a fight can be when it's 5 or 6 Indian men assaulting one white man. Some say the white man did lose his eye, but blamed himself for the fight and for his injury. Some say he became a better man because of his missing eye. Yes, some folks have turned that murder story into a mythical tale about redemption. Some folks, some creative storytellers, have changed a violent Indian man into the spiritual teacher of a one-eyed white wanderer. We all justify our sins, venial or mortal. There was also a third murderer at that New Year's Eve party, but that killing would take place a few years later. So maybe I should say there was a future murderer at the party. And that murder would take place in a convenience store parking lot in Spokane. It would happen in an old car. One of my father's more distant friends would shoot and kill one of my father's closest cousins. He served only 5 or 8 years in prison for the murder, and then vanished, either to escape the Indians' intent on revenge, or because those vengeful Indians had made him vanish. But no, my little sister fact-checked me and said, "That guy got out of prison and lived in a HUD house on the res until he died." What? I said. He lives in Welponet? No way. Did you ever talk to him? He tried to talk to us, she said, but I just walked past him. And nobody tried to get revenge on him? No, he was just an outcast. People walked circles around him like he was a disease. That's all that happened to him? I asked. Killers get away with killing, she said. So yes, I grew up with murderers. But strangely enough, I wasn't all that worried about their presence at that New Year's Eve party. I wasn't afraid of being killed as much as I was afraid of being sexually abused. I knew there would be 5 or 6 party guests who'd sexually molested my friends and cousins. There would be guests who raped only adults, and guests who'd raped only children, and opportunists who had and would violate any vulnerable woman, man, or child. I'd been abused by one man. I knew he'd be at the party, so I assumed I'd have to specifically protect myself against him, and generally protect myself against all of the other predators. As an adult, I can look back at the violence on my reservation and logically trace it back to the horrific degradations, sexual and otherwise, committed against my tribe by generations of white American priests, nuns, soldiers, teachers, missionaries, and government officials. The abused can become abusers. It's a tragic progression. But as a child, even a very bright child, I had little knowledge of Native American history. We Spokane Indian children weren't even taught about our own tribal history. I only knew my personal history. And, in my story, the villains were other Spokane Indians. My monsters had brown skin with dark hair and eyes, and they looked like me. So, as my mother and father prepared for that New Year's Eve party, I walked downstairs into my bedroom, reached far under my bed, and pulled out a clear plastic bag, heavy, with 40 metal butter knives. I'd purchased a bag of used knives at Goodwill, or Value Village, or Salvation Army, or some other second-hand store. Or maybe I bought them at Dutch's Pawn Shop in downtown Spokane. I don't remember. But I do recall that the bag cost me $2. That was a significant amount of money for a poor reservation kid. I could have bought at least 30 pieces of penny candy at Irene's grocery store. But even as a kid, I had more important uses for my money than sweets. I needed knives. And I shoved them, one by one, into the narrow gap between my bedroom door and the jamb. This locked the door in place. It could not be easily opened. That door looked like a giant wood and metal porcupine, fierce and ready to defend me. But alas, that door and jamb were actually hollow and thin. The knives were cheap and pliable. I still hoped their combined strength would be enough to keep the door shut against any monsters. Well, truthfully, I knew those knives were not strong enough to keep a dedicated monster from breaking into my room. But those 40 knives would be strong enough to make a monster pause and reconsider. Those 40 knives would make a monster worry that he was making too much noise as he beat at the door. He'd be scared that the noise would attract the attention of other adults. Maybe my parents, if they weren't too bottle blind, who would then come downstairs to investigate the commotion. Those 40 knives might make a monster wonder if I was armed with other, sharper knives. Maybe that monster would decide to search for an easier target. Do you know that old joke about how you don't have to run faster than a charging grizzly? You just have to run faster than your hiking companions? Well, I was using the same survivor logic. My bedroom fortress didn't need to be impenetrable. It just needed to be stronger than everybody else's defenses, stronger than all of the other Indian children who were as vulnerable, or more vulnerable, than me. Self-preservation was my religion. Above all else, I knew Those 40 butter knives would delay the monster long enough for me to climb through my basement window and escape into the pine forest behind my house. I'd spent so much time in those woods that I'd memorized them. I could safely run and avoid all the trees, fallen and not. I could leap the small creek and hurdle the glacial boulders. It would not have mattered if the forest was barely lit by moonlight or not illuminated at all. I wasn't afraid of the dark nearly as much as I was afraid of the monsters who hunted by night and day. But the monsters didn't come after me that night. Instead, it was my parents who terrified me the most. I was still awake at midnight when the party went into full crazy mode with singing and screaming and cursing and pistols and rifles fired into the night sky. Those reservation Indian parties felt less like celebrations and more like ceremonial preparation for a battle that never quite arrived. But I was asleep when I heard my father curse and grunt and war whoop, when I heard bodies slamming into walls, when I heard my father cry out in pain. Stupidly, bravely, I crawled out of bed, pulled the 40 butter knives from my door, keeping one as a dull weapon, and ran upstairs. I was only 7 or 8 or 9 years old, but I was going to defend my father. I'd always been that foolish and brave. When I was 4, I picked up a miniature wooden baseball bat and attacked the skulls, arms, and legs of 3 white boys who were picking on my big brother in a motel parking lot in Spokane. I chased those white boys away and then, still blind with rage, attacked my brother. And, as he often had to do during our youth, he disarmed me and bear-hugged me until I, exhausted and furious, passed out in his arms. At that New Year's Eve party, I raced up the stairs, whipped open the door expecting to stab the men attacking my father, but was surprised to see he was playing a rough version of rugby, wrestling, boxing, and one-on-one Nerf basketball against an Indian friend. One of those guys nicknamed Bug or Mouse or Poochie. My father and his friend were drunkenly laughing and bleeding from various cuts and scrapes. They were unholy clowns. Dozens of partygoers were cheering and making bets. Nobody noticed me. I wasn't scared as much as I was confused. Then my father and his friend, locked in a violent embrace, Russell staggered toward me. I froze. And I would have likely been knocked over and maybe badly hurt, but some conscientious drunk pulled me out of the way. And I watched as my father and his friend pulled and pushed each other through the open basement door, the door I had left open, and tumbled down the thinly carpeted staircase. Fearing they had killed themselves, I ran to the top of the staircase to see them, even more bloody and bruised, weakly laughing in a 2-man pile on the basement floor. They were too drunk and injured to stand, so they soon fell asleep, still wrapped in each other's arms. Meanwhile, my mother was playing poker against a group of other native women. "You're cheating me," my mother screamed at Birdie, a Spokane Indian woman who was not much bigger than me. "No, Lillian," Birdie said. "I don't know how to play. I'm not cheating. Teach me how to play." My mother screamed again and punched Birdie in the mouth. Birdie grabbed her face and wept. My mother punched her in the forehead. Then Birdie wailed like a rabbit being killed by a hawk. She was only bruised and bloody, but her pain still sounded like a death cry. "Why did you hit me?" Birdie howled. "Why? Why? Why?" I remember the blood ran between Birdie's teeth like water flowing around river rocks. "Lillian, why did you hit me?" Birdie wailed. "Lillian! Lillian!" I was terrified and turned to run back downstairs, but somebody picked me up, carried me to the master bedroom and threw me onto the bed, where a dozen other Indian kids were already wrapped around one another like a frightened litter of pups. I found my little sisters in that dark scrum, and we held hands until we fell asleep. At dawn, My mother woke my sisters and me. My big brother stood at her side. I don't know where he had slept that night. In his room? At our cousin's house? In a tree in the woods behind our house? "Wake up! Wake up!" my mother said. "We're leaving, and we're never coming back." Exhausted, terrified, my siblings and I followed our mother outside to the car. We all piled into the back seat without seat belts, kids' seats, or any other kind of safety, as Mom started the engine and sped us away from our HUD house. She cursed our father as she drove. She also sang Christian hymns. She sang ancient Spokane Indian songs that sounded like each note was filled with 10,000 years of grief. Our mother drove us to Chewila, Washington, the small white town north of the reservation where she was born. In her most desperate and lonesome moments, my mother often returned like a salmon to her place of birth, which had been a Spokane Indian gathering place in earlier centuries. Once in Chewila, she pulled us out of the car and into a diner. We shuffled past white customers who stared at us with hate, pity, disgust, and anger. The four horsemen of the anti-Indian apocalypse. Then my mother ordered us into a back booth and called for the waitress. "Pancakes and bacon and orange juice," my mother ordered, "for everybody." The white waitress looked at us four Indian kids still dressed in the clothes we'd slept in, and then she stared at me. "Your nose is bleeding," she said. I wiped my face and looked at the red glow on my fingers. "His nose bleeds when he's heated up," my mother said. It was true, but the waitress had her doubts. "Did somebody hit you, baby?" the waitress asked me. I thought about lying. I thought about blaming my mother. I thought about telling the waitress that my mother had slapped me. I thought about being rescued by white people. But I was more afraid of any white people than I was of my Indian mother. "My mom saved us," I said. "She saved us from drunks." The waitress looked down at my bare and dirty feet. My mother had dragged her kids out of the house without putting socks and shoes on us. It was winter, but I don't remember if my bare feet felt cold. They had to be cold. But I don't trust this particular detail. I don't believe we left the house with bare feet. There's no way our mother made us walk with bare feet in the snow and ice. She would not have done that to us, right? I think my mind is adding a Dickensian detail to heighten the narrative punch. I hope our bare winter feet are only a metaphor or simile. I hope it means our cheap shoes weren't much better than bare feet. "Did your daddy hit you?" the waitress asked me. "No," I said. "It was the other men who hurt us. Mommy saved us from the other men." The waitress knelt beside me. "You can tell me the truth," the waitress said. "Do you need help, little sweetie?" "I'm hungry," I said. "I'm thirsty." The waitress brought us our breakfast. Then she said that she'd pay for it when my mother said she didn't have any money. And then, as we prepared to leave the diner, that kind waitress needed to help us even more. "You take these kids somewhere safe," that waitress said to my mother. "Don't go back to that place you ran from." I don't remember my mother's response to that waitress. I can only imagine my mother's desperation and fear. She'd wanted to escape. She'd wanted to rescue her kids. But where could she go? Was there a place where she and her kids could be safe? Has there ever been a place in the United States where a poor Native woman and her kids could be truly safe? She had no money. She had no knowledge of family shelters. Did those even exist in the early 1970s? She must have debated her options. She knew that Indian children were often taken from their families for the flimsiest of reasons. As a late 20th century continuation of official government assimilation and termination efforts. Split up, separated, we kids would be sent to foster homes, where we'd be in potential danger. We might be sent to the last Indian boarding schools, where we would definitely be in danger. Our mother had already lost us once to social services. A second time might mean she'd lose us for good. She couldn't risk it. She couldn't trust any white officials. She had to go home. So my mother drove us back to the reservation, back to our HUD house. Almost all of the partygoers were gone. My father, scratched and bloody and bruised, was asleep alone in his bed. My mother and my siblings and I crawled into bed with him. We slept all day and long into the night. At some point, my mother woke alone and cleaned the house. Then she woke us, her children, and promised us that she would stop drinking booze that very second and would never drink again. My mother was a liar. She broke many promises over the coming decades, but she kept that greatest of vows. She was sober for the rest of her life, and that's why I am still alive. Chapter 2, Sacred Heart. In May 2015, my mother, struggling to breathe, was rushed from the reservation to Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane, where she was eventually diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. She was 78 years old and had been suffering with major and minor health problems since her husband, my father, had died 12 years earlier. I knew Parkinson's wasn't fatal, but it can significantly reduce a person's lifespan and lead to severe physical and mental impairment, especially for older people. How quickly would it transform my elderly but mostly self-sufficient mother into an utter dependent? And what about the quality of her last years? How could I make sure she lived and died well? I am not an organized person, but I suddenly felt the need to make serious and complicated plans for my mother's life, for the end of her life. However, it felt more like formal duty than affection. My mother and I had often been estranged. We'd battled and exiled each other. And then, after my father's death, we'd settled into a relationship based on irregular phone calls and occasional visits. My mother and I loved each other. Mostly or partly loved each other, I think. But I'd always felt the need to armor myself against her emotional excesses, and I imagine she felt the same about me. But she needed me now, financially and spiritually. So I booked an immediate flight from Seattle to Spokane to visit her and my siblings in Sacred Heart Hospital. In my taxi to the airport, I researched senior care facilities in Seattle and Spokane. Some of them were quite beautiful and offered extensive programs for residents with Parkinson's. They also seemed to be legal pyramid schemes where elderly patients and their families poured money into end-of-life rent rivers that only flowed up toward the corporate owners and stockholders. But if I were to be grifted, then let the grift be lovely. I did the math on my book sales and expected royalties and knew I could afford a great place for my mother in Spokane if I gave up my outside office and worked only at home. Maybe I could do more lucrative gigs speaking on college campuses. Maybe I could return to script doctoring in Hollywood. I had many financial opportunities, some more probable and profitable than others. I was the lucky Native American son, the fortunate writer, who could take good care of his dying Native American mother. Isn't that an oddly tribalistic and narcissistic realization? Then again, isn't tribalism a form of group narcissism? I can put Mom in a fancy place by the little Spokane River, I said to my sister on the phone from my departure gate in Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. That's what she was worried about today, my sister said. She thinks we're gonna put her in an old folks' home and forget about her. Indians don't do that, I said, instantly romanticizing my race. Some Indians do, my sister said, immediately deromanticizing us. I can also rent a cheap studio apartment near the senior citizen home, I said. It's just a few blocks away, and you guys can stay there when you're visiting her. You can take turns seeing her every day. I felt my back spasm and ache from the heavy burden of my messiah complex. She doesn't want to be in a place where everybody is white, my sister said. She thinks old white people will be racist toward her. I don't think she's wrong, I said. I bet old white people are probably more racist in Spokane. Old people are probably more racist everywhere. Just look at Clint Eastwood. I thought about my late father, a Coeur d'Alene Indian, who'd gradually grown more racist as he aged. But it was a passive form of racism, if there is such a thing, in which he would use a lesser racist epithet to describe a person after a relatively tense encounter. Aside from the time he called a white cop Custer, my father never insulted anybody to their face. He once came out of a 7-Eleven complaining about the towel head who owned the place. So I called my father Buffalo Head for the rest of the day to shame him for his racism. That wasn't quite a progressive move on my part. I wondered if my mother had also grown more racist in her elderly years. I hadn't spent concentrated time with her since my father's death, so I didn't know exactly how my mother's personality and politics might have changed. I knew she was a fan of the callow Sarah Palin, only because that former vice presidential candidate had married a dude with a Yupik great-grandmother. But strangely enough for an activist artist like me, I had never thought about how white privilege, or lack thereof, can extend even into the last few days of a person's life. I now had to worry about my mother being racially harassed as she was dying. So I researched senior citizens' homes that catered to more diverse populations, a difficult task in the very white cities of Spokane and Seattle. But I found a few reservation-based facilities that specialized in taking care of Native Americans. There is an elder care place on the Colville Indian Res, I said to my sister as I waited in the Seattle airport. That res-based nursing home was 100 miles from my mother's home on the Spokane Indian Reservation. Is it Indian Health Service? My sister asked. I think so, I said. That's kind of worrisome, isn't it? I worried about the quality of a government facility that served only Indians. Scenes from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest flashed through my head. I didn't want to turn my mother into Chief Broom or Randall P. McMurphy. I didn't want her shuffling through the hospital hallways leaning on a walker made of elk bones and coyote spit. I also wondered if my mother would want to live out her last years on another tribe's reservation. I'd been an urban Indian for half my life, and was often the only Indian at any gathering. But living on another tribe's reservation felt even more alienating to me. How would it feel to my reservation-bound mother? Maybe there will be some old Colville Indians who speak a little Spokane, I said. Maybe Mom will get to gossip in the old language, even if she's on somebody else's res. The Colvilles and Spokane speak tribal languages that are related and share some words, but they are distinct dialects. I think Mom would be even lonelier around a bunch of old Indian strangers, my sister said. I wouldn't want to live on somebody else's res. How about senior housing in Wahlponet, I asked. Maybe I could hire a full-time nurse to live with Mom there. No way, my sister said. Auntie Vi lives there, and they can't stand each other. Despite living only a few miles apart, my mother and her eldest sister hadn't spoken in a decade. My mom had always been good at making enemies. Her sister, nicknamed Nasty Nanny, was even better at it. We can just take care of Mom at home, my sister said. None of us knew how sick my mother might become, how difficult it could be to take care of her. We didn't know if she would eventually need help on a weekly or daily or hourly basis. My sisters were not physically well either. I worried they'd endanger their health by taking care of our mother. I want Mom to have expert care, I said. She just wants to be home, my sister said. Okay, I have to hang up now, I said. My plane is boarding. I'll see you at the hospital in a couple of hours. In 1966, I was born in Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane. My father died in Sacred Heart in 2003. He'd wanted to die at home, but he was suffering and suffocating, drowning in his own fluids. So my mother and sisters had rushed him to the hospital. I'd seen him on his last night at home on the reservation, but fled back to Seattle rather than be with him in his last moments. He'd often abandoned me when I was a child. He'd often chosen to go on days and weeks-long drinking binges instead of staying home with his wife and kids. So, to be blunt, I chose to leave him in the same way he had left me. In that difficult time, I chose to be with my wife and children, the family I had created, instead of the family I was born into. Did that decision make me a bad son? I suppose it did. Do I feel guilty about it? Yes. But I don't regret my decision. Given the chance to travel back in time, I would have still abandoned my father, so I could be a father to my sons. So yeah, if you close your eyes and listen hard, then you can hear a drum group singing a powwow version of Cats in the Cradle. Coffee spoon way high, oh. Indian moon way high, oh. Daddy is drunk at noon and won't be home soon. Way ah, way ah, way ah, ho. But my father wasn't alone in his hospital room, on his deathbed. My mother and sisters were at his side. At home in Seattle, I called his room in Sacred Heart. How is Dad? I asked my sister when she answered. He's leaving us, she said. His breathing is really slowing down. He's not responding to us. Put the phone up to his ear, I said. Okay, my sister said. Dad, I said into the phone. It's me. I heard him sigh and move. I heard my mother and sisters gasp. Somewhere deep in his morphine coma, my father had recognized my voice and was trying to respond, had responded in the only way he could. Dad, I said, it's okay. You can let go. I love you. You can let go. You can stop fighting. It's time to say goodbye. I love you. I love you. Goodbye. 12 hours later, as I walked through a Seattle toy store with my sons, ages 2 and 6, my sister called to tell me that our father had died. I paid for my son's new toys, drove us home, and helped them into the house. Then, as my wife held our boys, I collapsed to the floor of our living room and wept. On my flight to Spokane, I used the airplane Wi-Fi to do more research on Parkinson's disease. It would certainly make my mother's last years incredibly difficult, even torturous. She'd be taking multiple medications many times a day. I wondered if Indian Health Service would cover everything, or if I would have to pay for some of the more expensive and experimental drugs. I then vowed to finally finish the years-late sequel to my best-selling book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. I needed that money. My mother needed that money. I hadn't been able to finish the book because of the pathological fear that my sequel would be The Phantom Menace instead of The Empire Strikes Back. But on the airplane, I thought, okay, Phantom sucked, but it still made big cash. I'm gonna Yoda this book for my mother. After landing in Spokane, I took a taxi to Sacred Heart Hospital and hurried to my mother's room. I leaned over and kissed her forehead. She wiped away tears and said hello. I hugged my sisters and my niece. She was our second cousin, but my sisters had adopted her and raised her as their daughter. My family, despite all of our troubles, had temporarily or permanently taken care of various cousins and friends over the years. In adulthood, many of my childhood friends told me they'd felt safer in our house than they ever did in their own homes. My father's drunken kindness and my mother's angry sobriety had provided an unlikely refuge on our reservation. "So what's the plan?" I asked my sister. "The doctor said they'll get Mom stabilized here and then send her to a rehabilitation center to work on her Parkinson's." "How long will she be there?" I asked.
6 to 8 weeks,"
my sister said. "I can pay for a private room," I said. "They want her to have a roommate, so she'll stay social." "Okay," I said. I sat on the bed next to Mom. "Hey, Lillian," I said. "How are you?" "I'm old," she said, and laughed. She was aware of her surroundings, but also seemed confused, like she was two people, one much older than the other. "How's your brain?" I asked her. "I get tired," she said, "and I forget things. Are you getting senile on me?" "I've been getting senile." I realized I had not seen her in at least 4 months. She'd been her usual witty self the last time we'd been together. But now, she seemed fragmented. "Do you like your doctor?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "She likes your books. She wants you to sign one for her." That was one of the best privileges of my literary fame. My parents had both received more attentive health care because they had conceived me. My father and I had the same name, so he'd often been asked by medical professionals to sign my books instead of me. "I'm going to take care of you, Mom," I said. That wasn't a lie, not exactly, but it didn't turn out to be true. During the early years of my writing career, my mother was afraid to tell me family stories. "You're just going to put things out there for everybody to read," she said. "Ugly things." But after I became more famous in the Indian world, after other natives would learn her last name and ask if she was related to me, and then ask for her autograph and take photos with her, my mother began to tell me more and more about her personal history. She was a storyteller, too. So, diagnosed with Parkinson's, exhausted and afraid, she lay in her hospital bed in Sacred Heart Hospital and told me another story about that old and primitive house on the rez, about who we used to be and who we would always be. I'd heard all of her stories multiple times. She repeated them and repeated them until I learned how to repeat them. When repeated enough times, the same story becomes a song. "Okay," she said. "So your dad's cousins, Bill and Tinker and Johnny, they were brothers. And they always slept in the attic. It wasn't insulated, but I don't remember how they stayed warm. I guess we had a lot of blankets. I don't think we had any sleeping bags, and even if we did, they would have been army surplus. And they would have smelled too moldy to use, and sometimes there were mice in them. You and Johnny had the same birthday. You shared a cake once. You weren't happy about that at all. You cried and cried. Tinker fought in Vietnam. It took him a while to get okay with that. Eugene and Leonard and Sam were brothers too, and your dad's cousins, and they lived in the attic sometimes. Until Sam went hitchhiking that one day and disappeared. Leonard moved to New Mexico and went to college for 20 years. Eugene still visited all the time, but I don't think he ever slept in our house again. Not in that old house, and not in the new one either. After Sam disappeared, Eugene never really lived anywhere again. And then he got murdered, remember? Shot in the parking lot of the liquor store?